I'd like to encourage you to open your Bibles to Psalm 31. Before we begin our study together, I would like to tell you what I think about this church. Amen. I think this is one amazing church. I don't know how many of you are familiar with other places or other congregations of the Lord's church. I have the privilege and I have the blessing of being able to get around quite a bit. And I just want you to know, from my personal observation, in just a matter of a weekend, I can definitely say and know that I cannot be contradicted in saying this. This is one amazing church, and those of you who are a part of it are richly blessed. Do not take your blessings for granted. Every church is not like this church. It was in the late 1980s. We were going to my children's grandparents for the weekend on Thanksgiving. When preachers go away on the weekend, the downside to it is you've got to get back for Sunday morning because there's church. That particular holiday weekend, spending it about 50 minutes away from our personal home at the children's grandparents' homes, we had a really nice Thanksgiving weekend. We chose to come back late that Saturday night. It was dark, of course, and it was just barely drizzling, a little bit of rain. We were headed north on State Route 43 in northeastern Ohio. There was an older couple who had come to Hartville, Ohio, and they had come there that night, that Saturday, for a wedding. The Burfords. Mr. Burford was a very well-known Mennonite preacher, now at this point retired. They'd come to Hartville for that wedding weekend, and they were headed home. And they were headed east. At 45 miles an hour in my 1985 Pontiac Bonneville, we collided with Mr. Burford's little 1970-something powder blue Ford Pinto right at his wife's door. I can still see that powder blue Ford Pinto in my mind right now, as clearly as I did that night. He ran a stop sign. Later that night, Mrs. Eileen Burford died as a result of that crash. I hated that. My wife and I had to go to the hospital. Our three children were picked up by a friend. They were not injured. My wife and I went to the hospital. She was injured a little bit and on crutches for a while. But Mr. Burford had lost his wife. That night, I had to call the elders of the church and tell them about what had happened, and I explained to them that there was no way in the world I was going to be able to preach that next morning. But I said, please give me the opportunity before dismissal of the folks at church, let me come over and explain what had happened. Because I knew what the news media was going to do with this particular incident. It was an intersection known as a somewhat dangerous intersection because there was free traffic going north and south, but a stop sign going east and west, and there were people who on occasion missed those stop signs going east or going west. And the fact that he was a retired Mennonite preacher, and I was a preacher in Stark County as well, I knew what the news media would do with that story. And that it would be in the news for a few days, especially because of Mrs. Burford's death. That Sunday morning, when I went over to the church building and explained to the folks what had happened, I hated to have to explain about what had happened the night before. And I was just so overwhelmed by what I was experiencing. I hated setting my children down that same day, that Sunday, and explaining to them that the car that they were in, that was in the accident that they had experienced also, was something that resulted in Mrs. Burford's death. I hated that. I don't know any time in my parenting life that I had ever been so burdened and so overwhelmed as I was that morning trying to explain that to my three little daughters. I remember going to Mrs. Burford's funeral. They chose to have it in Hartville, Ohio, at the same building where they had been for that wedding that weekend. I was sitting about halfway back in the middle of a packed house. The Burfords were known by all the Mennonites in eastern Ohio, western Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. Everybody knew the Burfords. When Mr. Burford got up during the course of his wife's memorial service, he recognized me and he called me out by name. And he asked me if I would stand. And he said to me publicly, "I want to thank you for helping me get my wife to heaven." And I was overwhelmed. I didn't know how to respond to that. I remember going to the courthouse the day he was arraigned because it was vehicular manslaughter. His wife died as a result of that accident. I remember going into the courthouse and how it was flooded with Mennonite people. And I remember how sorry I felt for him and how overwhelmed I was for him, with him agonizing with this situation as well. I have on many occasions asked myself, why did we not leave earlier on that Saturday to go back to our home? Why hadn't we caught one traffic light, at least one traffic light, or had not caught one traffic light that night on the way home? Why was it that I had to be right there at that time, and why did he have to miss that stop sign? Yeah, I was overwhelmed by that experience. When my youngest daughter was 10 years old, she was diagnosed with a neurological condition. She was what is primarily described by the medical profession as asymptomatic. She was not vomiting, and she didn't have the headaches that would be typical of somebody who had this problem. But in a cerebral aqueduct in her brain, there was a restriction or constriction of some sort that was causing this fluid buildup in her brain to push her brain up against her skull. It's called hydrocephalus, excessive fluid in the brain. Her cranial pressure was all out of whack. When we took her to a neurologist and to a neurosurgeon, they said, "Don't be concerned. We can fix this because this is one of the most common surgeries that a neurosurgeon will do." One of the problems with that particular occasion was I had not a clue that there was something called a pediatric neurosurgeon, a specialty within a specialty. So she had that surgery at 10 years old. We brought her home. At the 30-day post-op surgical visit with that neurologist, we thought things were okay, but they weren't okay. They were dangerous now, because what had happened when her brain came back from her skull and wasn't pressuring her skull, what had happened when that brain had been pushing up against that skull, there were these, forgive my lack of medical terminology, these tributaries that were running there carrying blood at the top of her brain. When that pressure was released, then she started bleeding in her brain. It's called bilateral subdural hematomas, bleeding on both sides of her brain. And now her brain is being pushed down after having been pushed up. And she's in jeopardy now. So we're told to go to Rainbow Baby and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, a part of the University Hospitals of Cleveland, a world-renowned children's hospital. And there at that hospital, there was the one and only pediatric neurosurgeon, between Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Cleveland, Ohio, a densely populated section of our country. There was only one, Dr. Mapstone. That summer, while she was 10 years old, she was in Rainbow Baby and Children's Hospital for 33 days. During that summer, she had 5 brain surgeries. Her head totally shaved, and she had 5 brain surgeries trying to save her. I remember when she was in PICU, pediatric intensive care, Dr. Mapstone coming in one day, and I don't know what else he said, except this is what I remember him saying on that occasion. He said, "Neurosurgeons are often the bearers of bad news." Reflecting on that now, I think what he was doing was prepping us for what may have been the worst outcome. There she was laying there, totally not responsive to physical or audible stimuli, in a comatose-like state. If you've ever, as a parent, been through something like that, you know about what it's like to be overwhelmed. Scared to death, crying buckets of tears, wondering about what life was going to be like now. One day when my wife was by her side, my wife took a raw carrot and bit into it and started chewing it. You know that sound? That real distinct sound? "What's that noise?" That's what our 10-year-old daughter said when she heard that noise. The first indication she was coming out of the coma. "What's that noise?" She did come out of the comatose-like state, but there were problems with that. She had to learn to walk again. She had to learn to feed herself again. She had months and months of physical and occupational therapy. During the period of time that she was up there in that hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, in between those surgeries, I distinctly remember one particular occasion with my wife. We had left the pre-surgical room, walking to the family waiting room, and I remember my wife crying tears and saying this, "I never want to walk down this hallway again." And you know, within 48 hours, we had to go walking through that hallway again. That summer, 5 brain surgeries. If you were to see her today, you'd never know what she'd experienced. But I'm telling you, when she was in that condition, we were overwhelmed. When my wife was in her early 50s, she was diagnosed with a neurological condition, Parkinson's disease. The neurology doctor said that when he saw her MRI, that it was a picture of a brain significantly discolored. Those were the two words he used, significantly discolored. That was the beginning of our journey with her having Parkinson's disease. She lost the ability to get up off of a chair. She lost the ability to be able to walk. She lost the ability to be able to get in and out of a car. She lost the ability to eat. She lost the ability to talk. She came into this world on September 22, 1952, totally dependent. And when she exited on Christmas morning of 2013 at 9:40 in the morning, she left a physical body that had become totally dependent again. There were times during that caregiving experience that I was overwhelmed. If you know somebody who is presently giving care to a loved one, or maybe to somebody in the community, don't just pray for them. Get involved and help them. Support them and encourage them. Caregiving is the hardest thing in the world I've ever done. I will go on record as saying I hate being widowed. But I will say right after that, I have done nothing, including life after loss, harder than caregiving. I was overwhelmed. Then she died. Now I've got to deal with loss and with beginning to try to live after loss. If you've never been through that, or you've never had a real close relationship with somebody who has, who's been gut honest with you about their life after loss, let me tell you, it's no picnic. I thought I knew, after being with people who had suffered loss for 32 years with the same church in Hartville, Ohio. When my wife passed away, we had worked with that church for 32 years. I thought I knew something about what they had experienced. I did know something about loss, and I learned it from them and from being with them in their losses. But what I was clueless about was life after loss. And that's where I started my journey that Christmas morning of 2013. You talk about feeling overwhelmed. My suspicion is, in a crowd this large, and looking at the gray hair and some bald heads, some of you could tell some stories about times when you have been overwhelmed too. And you know what it's like to feel that way. It feels like you're submerged in your negative circumstances. I am not your typical male for a lot of reasons. Part of the reason why I'm not a typical male is I have three daughters and I had a wife for 41 years. I suffer from overexposure to the female gender, so I'm not normal. One of the things that's abnormal about me is I don't use a dishwasher. I wash dishes. Now, when I wash dishes, and I like to cook and I like even more to bake, but when I wash dishes, there's some things I have to be careful about not submerging in that soapy dishwater. You know what I mean by submerge. Being overwhelmed is like being submerged in your negative circumstances. Another synonym a dictionary will give you is the word crushed. You know, sometimes you are carrying heavy burdens in your life. And boy, those burdens, sometimes it can just be one big one. But sometimes it might be one big one, and then in addition to that, a bunch more too. And you begin to feel crushed with the weight of what you're dealing with. It could be a child or a grandchild that's straying away from the Lord. You're heartsick about it. It could be your parents that you're concerned about because they're struggling with their aging or their health. It could be the predicaments of your marriage that are not well, and the stress and the strain that you're experiencing in your marriage. It could be your dysfunctional family. It could be the fact that you've been diagnosed with cancer, or somebody that you love, maybe somebody you've lived with, they're suffering with cancer. There are times in your life when the circumstances of your life cause you to feel as if you're being submerged in negativity and crushed by the burdens. Let me share with you a thought that I think is very important for us to keep in mind, especially if we're trying to be Christians and people devoted to the Lord. I don't have a lot of time to deal with this. We dealt with this Friday night a little bit, but let me suggest to you a philosophy you might want to park in your brain somewhere. Yes, life has a lot of difficulties. There are a lot of things that we can experience that can cause us to feel overwhelmed. But please remember this. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will. Do you really think it's God's will for us to be dealing with domestic violence? For drunks to be going left of center? For there to be rampant sexual immorality? I mean, there are a lot of things in this world that God doesn't want us to have to deal with in this world. It's not what He desires. Not everything that happens in this world is God's will, but in everything that happens, God has a will. You know what His will is? When you're super blessed, what He wants is for Him to be glorified and you to be a blessing for others. When you're in deep heartache and you're overwhelmed by your life circumstances, God wants him to be glorified and you to be a blessing to other people. That's consistently what he wants. But sometimes when we're overwhelmed, it's hard to function like that. Psalm 31. Take a look at Psalm 31. I don't know exactly when in David's life this was written. You know, he went from shepherd boy to king. He experienced tremendous blessings, and he also carried tremendous burdens and dealt with stress on steroids. I don't know when exactly this was in his life, but here's what I do know. When this old boy took up pen and put this to paper, or however it was written, I know he was tanking. He was in bad shape, and here's why I know. Pick up at verse 9. Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am in trouble. My eye wastes away with grief. Yes, my soul and my body, for my life is spent with grief and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity and my bones waste away. I am a reproach among all my enemies, but especially among my neighbors, and am repulsive to my acquaintances, and those who see me outside flee from me. I am forgotten like a dead man out of mind. I am like a broken vessel. For I hear slander, the slander of many, fear on every side. While they take counsel together against me, they scheme to take away my life. You think it's legitimate to call him overwhelmed? I can't think of a better word to use to describe what he was going through. I just read from the New King James Version. Real quickly, I want to show you some words. Verse 7, he talks about my trouble. In verse 7, he talks about his soul in adversities. In verse 9, the word trouble pops up again. In verse 11, the word reproach. Then verse 11, the word repulsive. And then in verse 13, the word slander. And then in verse 13, again, the word scheme. And then in verse 15, the word persecute. Yes, he was going through a very difficult time in his life. And it was having a tremendous impact on him. When have you ever been through a time where you felt like your bones were wasting away? When you felt like you were a broken vessel. I love the poetic way he talks about his circumstances and the impact of those circumstances in his life. How in the world did this man ever keep his head above water? How in the world did he ever survive this experience of being overwhelmed? I think he tells us. I think there's insight in this psalm where you can see that. The first thing that he did was he trusted the Lord. Look how often trust is mentioned in this psalm. Look at verse 1. Again, reading from the New King James Version. In you, O Lord, I put my trust. Some translations, it's refuge. Whenever you're in a scary time in your life, when the storms are coming, what do? You head for shelter. What kind of shelter do you head for? You head for shelter you can trust. When I used to live in Murray City, Tennessee, I would get off Route 419 and turn left and head toward Murray City. And there, as I headed toward Murray City on the left-hand side, I remember there was a yard there where there was this build-up hump, and then there was like a door into that hump, like a tornado shelter, a place to take refuge when things got really scary and you felt like you were in jeopardy. You take refuge where you feel like you can be safe, where you can be protected, a place that you can trust. Drop down to verse 6. I have hated those who regard useless idols, but I trust in the Lord. Look at verse 14. But as for me, I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies. And then there's an expression that he uses that we most often will relate to Jesus at the cross. But David said it first. Look at verse 5. Into your hand I commit my spirit. What is trust? When you go to a bank with a check, you give them that check. You give them your money. It's an entrustment. You're giving it to them because you feel like you can trust them so that when you need it, you can then withdraw. When you, as a younger parent, need childcare, where do you go? You go to somebody you can trust. Most often, you have to pay for it. But let me recommend something to those of you who are younger parents. Go to the grandparents first. They're a lot cheaper than a teenager. I know grandparents that would almost pay their own kids to take care of the grandkids. Don't pay anybody for childcare. Check with Papa Nana first. What you're doing when you're doing that, you're entrusting the children into the welfare of somebody else. Proverbs chapter 3, probably the most familiar passage in Proverbs. Trust in the Lord. That's telling us what we should do and in whom we should do it. We should trust. In whom or in what should we trust? Trust in the Lord. How should we do that? Trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Well, what does that mean? Trust in the Lord with all of your heart and do not lean, here's your explanation about what that means. Do not lean on your own understanding in all your ways. Acknowledge Him. Let Him direct your paths. Surrender. Surrender yourself to the care of and the direction of somebody else who knows way more than you know. Look at the cry here of David in verse 3. For you are my rock and my fortress, therefore for your name's sake, lead me and guide me. That's trust. He's begging the Lord in this critical time when he's overwhelmed to lead him and guide him. And the only way that's going to happen is if David commits himself to the care of the Lord. Into your hands, I commit my spirit. When you're overwhelmed in your life, there is nothing more important than reminding yourself constantly, no matter how you feel, to, with a strong will, trust in the Lord. But David also mentions some other things. Here's another one. Remember His goodness. Turn, if you would, to verse 19 of this psalm. Oh, how great is your goodness, which you have laid up for those who fear you, which you have prepared for those who trust in you in the presence of the sons of men. You shall hide them in the secret place of your presence from the plots of man. You shall keep them secretly in a pavilion from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for He has shown me His marvelous kindness in a strong city. Notice verse 19, goodness. Divine goodness. Notice the adjective describing the goodness. Oh, how great is your goodness. Then drop down to verse 21. Kindness is mentioned. Divine kindness. What adjective is used to describe it? Marvelous kindness. God is good all the time. It's because of His goodness we have blessings beyond what we could possibly count, and way beyond what we need, and way, way beyond what we deserve. The goodness of God. But sometimes, our burdens blind us to our blessings. That's a human struggle. We are always, no matter how you feel, we are always more blessed than we're burdened. Now, we may not feel that way, but we always are. if you were here at the widowhood workshop Friday night or Saturday. We looked at Job chapter 14, verse 1. And Job said his life was full of trouble. Full of trouble. That's what he said. He still had a wife. Do you know what I would give to still have my wife? She may not have been a five-star wife, but he still had a wife. His heart was still beating. The blood was still coursing through that man's veins. That man had friends. They may not have always been five-star friends, but he had three that dropped everything in their life to come to him for the right purpose, to mourn with him and to comfort him. He had friends. Do you know how important friends are in our lives? And most importantly, he had the Lord. He had the Lord watching over him and providentially caring for him and even protecting him. God was on the throne, as he has always been, and in control of that whole situation. God is the one who drew the lines and said, "Satan, you can play within those lines, but you ain't getting outside of my lines. I'm in control." God knew what Job could endure with his help. Job even got so far down in the pit that in chapter 7, verse 6, he said his life had no hope. He had a lot of hope because he had a God in heaven who was watching over him. There's never a time when we as Christians are without hope. Our hope is about the unseen, about the spiritual, about the eternal. And nothing we experience in this life can steal that hope. We need to remember that when we're burdened, that the goodness of God is providing more blessings than we feel that we are burdened. My children were raised on the Smurfs. Papa Smurf was a wise Smurf. Gargamel and Azrael were the enemy. Gargamel and Azrael tricked the Smurfs to get them at the perfect place. Encircled the Smurfs, Gargamel and Azrael encircled the Smurfs in a ring of fire, and the Smurfs were about to become toast. But Papa Smurf, knowing what was right, said, "Kids, Smurfs, sing with me. Sing with me. I'll save your ears by singing. I'll quote the lyrics of what Papa Smurf told the Smurfs to sing." Goodness makes the badness go away. Goodness makes you happy every day. Badness cannot start. When there's goodness in your heart, goodness makes the badness go away. Now, that's not literally true. The goodness of God does not make all the badness go away, but us dwelling constantly and reminding ourselves constantly about the goodness of God can help us to handle the badness in our life. But if we keep our focus on the badness, we're going to continue to sink ourselves and make ourselves even feel worse than we already do. Never forget the goodness of God when you're struggling with your overwhelming circumstances. Notice he concludes the psalm with a third thing that obviously was key to him surviving. Verse 23 says, "Oh, love the Lord, all his saints, for the Lord preserves the faithful and fully repays the proud person. Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all you who hope in the Lord." Sometimes the phrase is "wait on the Lord." That's an interesting study. There's a book here on this table, a display table. By the way, let me explain about the display table. You probably have sat in Bible classes where people have fussed and talked about the unpardonable sin. I can tell you what the unpardonable sin is. It's stealing the preacher's books in the house of the Lord. Those are my books over there. They're there as display. If there's something there that can help you, take a picture of it, give your phone to somebody younger than you are, and they can get you that delivered by Amazon right to your house. There's a book over there. There's a book over there called "Those Who Wait." It's a study about this phrase, waiting on the Lord or hoping in the Lord. Rosemary Whittle McKnight wrote that book. Rosemary and I went to school together at Freed Hardeman. It's a tremendous book. There are over 20 times in the Bible this phrase occurs. There really is a need for all of us. There always has been. Whether you're talking about the patriarchal era, or you're talking about the Mosaic era, or you're talking about the Christian era, there has always been a need for people who exist in the image of God to wait on Him. That's hard to do, especially when we're overwhelmed. How much more can I take? How much longer can I endure this? Those are typical human questions that all of us have probably asked at different times in our life. Do you know, sometimes we need to remember that waiting has great value. Take a cocoon, for instance. Would you want to open it before it's time? Or what about the eggs in an incubator? You want to crack them open before their time? Of what value is that? There are times in our life that we're in God's waiting room, and we need to realize there's a purpose in that. There's a value in that. It may not be clear to us, but there is. And it can be a very painful experience. It's like going to the gymnasium, where you exercise yourself so that physically you can be in a better condition, but sometimes that hurts. That's hard. Waiting on the Lord can be very hard. That's why we sometimes sing, "Teach me, Lord, to wait." It's hard for us human beings to wait. See, we operate here like microwaves. God does the crockpot thing. So it's causing us a problem. We don't know how much longer. Here's what I know. Waiting, the word wait is a verb. Verbs are often action words. If you were to go to a restaurant, there are what are called waiters or waitresses. I'm not sure that that's legitimate gender distinct terminology that we can use anymore, but you know what I mean. Waiters. What do waiters do? Waiters at restaurants serve. Do you know what we should do when we're in God's waiting room? We should serve the Lord. You know, one of the best therapies to help people who are overwhelmed? Go help other people who are overwhelmed. Just get out there and serve. Sometimes that demands that we take our willer and get a hold of our wanter and drag our wanter to where it needs to be. Serving. There is a lot of value in us using our difficult, stressful life circumstances to be a blessing to other people. And when we're actively participating in helping other people, like many in this church have been, because of what this community has experienced, that's extremely therapeutic. The Hobby Lobby verse in the Bible, that's what I call it. The last verse of Isaiah chapter 40 reads like this. Bet you've seen this in Hobby Lobby on some piece of home interior decoration. But those who wait on the Lord, there's that phrase. But those who wait on the Lord, well, what about them? They shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not be faint. Boy, that sounds pretty pie in the sky. Because I'm telling you what, some days I feel exhausted. You know, it's sad that I think we miss the context. To appreciate the value of that last verse in Isaiah chapter 40, let me go up to verse 28. Listen carefully to a list of rhetorical questions. This is 29, verse 29 of Isaiah 40. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak. And to those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord, see what he's doing in that passage? When we are struggling, when we are really struggling in our life, we feel weak and we are confused. What we need to do is go to somebody who has infinite strength and unsearchable wisdom. That's the Lord. You know what you need most when you're struggling with an overwhelming time in your life? The same thing that you need when your life is good and you're enjoying great prosperity. What you need is the Lord. Edwin White wrote a book called A Sense of Presence. And in that book, he made this statement. When we reduce life to its essentials, only one thing is needful. To have God. Amen. That's exactly right. If we have God in our life, and we are enjoying great prosperity, God will be glorified and many people will be blessed. If we are struggling with tremendous adverse circumstances, but we have God, God can be glorified and people can be blessed if we keep waiting on Him, serving Him, trusting in Him, remembering His goodness all the way along. At the end of my wife's memorial service, a young man sang this song. Often I'm hindered on my way, burden so heavy I almost fall. Then I hear Jesus sweetly say, heaven will surely be worth it all. Heaven will surely be worth it all, worth all the trials that here befall after this life, with all of its strife. Heaven will surely be worth it all. Never forget that. There have been many times since my wife has passed away, I have orally aloud quoted those words. I need to keep hearing them. I need to keep seeing them in the songbook. This morning, if you're burdened with a load of sin, there is no reason for you to continue to live like that. There is hope and there is help for those who are overwhelmed spiritually. And the only person who can help you is the Father in heaven. Jesus died for our forgiveness, but we've got to be willing to accept the gift. If this morning you want to come with a penitent heart, simply trusting in Him and the sacrifice made for Him, for you, by Him, we're going to sing a song of invitation. If you're troubled with something in your life right now, maybe other people don't know about it, you feel free to come and ask for help. Troubled marriage, dysfunctional family, dying inside because of your loneliness, crippled by the stress that you're dealing with, caregiving, is there something that we can help you with by being more supportive and helpful because we become more aware because you come and ask for prayer? You need to come? Go ahead and come.